Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the release of the 11 million documents from a Panamanian law firm, a massive data dump that should prove to be the single biggest blow to the offshore world of tax havens and clandestine webs of shell companies that hide the ill-gotten gains of dictators and kleptocrats, along with the hidden wealth of the world's elite of business moguls, celebrities, and politicians. Gerard Ryle, the director of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, who organized the international effort to structure and release the Panama Papers to more than 100 media outlets worldwide, joins us to discuss how the ICIJ handled this enormous trove of financial and legal documents going back decades that were reported to be leaked to the German newspaper Süddeutsche Zeitung from the database of Mossack Fonseca, the world's fourth largest offshore law firm situated in Panama. Then we'll follow up with James Henry, who is a Global Justice Fellow at Yale University and the Senior Fellow at the Columbia University Center for Sustainable Investment and a Senior Economic Advisor to the Tax Justice Network. We will discuss the political resistance to going after tax havens and offshore and onshore shell companies and why it took whistleblowers and journalists to uncover this tip of the iceberg of global corruption and not governments and law enforcement. The answer being in large part because the rich and powerful have their money commingled with the scum of the earth. Then finally, we will speak with Gabriel Sherman, the National Affairs Editor at New York Magazine and author of the New York Times bestselling biography of Fox News founder Roger Ailes, The Loudest Voice in the Room, How the Brilliant, Bombastic Roger Ailes Built Fox News and Divided a Country. He joins us to discuss his latest article at New York Magazine, Operation Trump, Inside the Most Unorthodox Campaign in Political History, and the leverage that Donald Trump has over Fox News. And joining us now is Gerard Ryle, who is the director of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists headquarters staff in Washington, D.C., who organized the international effort to structure and release the Panama Papers. Previously, he spent 26 years working as a reporter, investigative reporter, and editor in Australia and Ireland, including 2 decades at the Sydney Morning Herald and the Age newspapers. He uncovered some of the biggest stories in Australian journalism, winning that country's highest journalism award 4 times. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gerard Ryle.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, I very much appreciate it, Gerard, and it's an extraordinary trove of information that is now becoming available, not all of it, obviously, and there's going to be some more pretty sensational stuff to come. But from what I've seen so far, it seems to reveal a kind of global tragedy in the sense that we have a phenomenon of Robin Hood in reverse, where we're robbing the third world and rewarding the first world, in as much as so much of this money is from the ill-gotten gains of dictators and kleptocrats, and it ends up ultimately on Wall Street, making the rich richer. Is that what is happening here at the end of the day?
Yeah, you've really nailed it in one go, because what's happening here is that, you know, we always ask, why does this world exist? Why don't first world leaders not step in and end it? Well, I think we're seeing the answers now. It's because people in power are basically using it. And, you know, you're wondering why, you know, prices are so high in California and New York and London. It's because the money is flowing from places like Russia and China and Africa and into this first world. So we're basically benefiting from the system. And I think the papers, the documents that we were revealing, actually show this in real time, because what they are actually 40 years of records of this offshore service provider, a company that actually sets up offshore accounts for clients.
So little wonder that London is now referred to as Moscow on the Thames.
Well, in fact, in the documents, you can see them buying the London property using offshore companies, and they actually get a double benefit from that, because they then avoid tax in London. But it also, you know, I mean, for the local people there, it drives up the prices enormously, because they're competing with billionaires.
So my understanding is from the work that the Tax Justice Network has done that the total of wealth in these tax havens is between $21 trillion and $32 trillion. Do you have a figure on this?
Well, the figure is very hard to sort of comprehend. But, I mean, the figure that I like to use, and it has been used again, but it's very difficult to verify, it's about a third of all world wealth. about half of all world trade goes through tax havens. So that's what you're seeing here. And the thing about tax havens is that they have one product, and that product is secrecy. And that's essentially, that's what it sells. So you go offshore for one reason only, and that is basically to have no one mind your business.
Well, already, you know, I got a sense that something was happening with your organization and this story because Putin's spokesperson, Dmitry Peskov, mentioned it a few days ago, and he tried to suggest that there was a state of information warfare going on with the West. I take it that that's how they're trying to spin it. But it does look as if the connections are pretty close to Putin, aren't they, in the form of his friend from school days, who the godfather of his daughter and the guy actually who introduced him to his wife.
Yeah, what we're seeing here, basically, before we even published, just as soon as we sent the questions to the Kremlin, they basically came out and attacked the stories. And of course, like all, like all very powerful people, they thought the story was just about them. And they didn't realize that this was a much bigger story. It actually, what we've revealed in the documents, and in fact, there are 12 current or former world leaders in the documents and more than 140 other politicians and hundreds of their associates. It wasn't about Russia, but of course Russia reacted as if it was just about them. But they were more than happy later in the week to talk about how we were revealing that the president of Ukraine basically had an offshore account that he hadn't declared. You know, and they're more than happy for us to reveal that the president, you know, the prime minister of Iceland had an offshore company with millions of dollars in bank bonds when he basically entered parliament in Iceland.
So is there a sense then that this, I mean, my sense is that this is, we've known about this for a long time, and I believe the offshore tax havens and tax shelters have really exploded since the 1970s. But what's your sense then of I mean, this is, there's more to come, so I imagine there'll be more and more global outrage. And again, you know, when you think about what this does to the third world, how it further impoverishes the already impoverished third world, how it basically says to, and after all, we're only 2 weeks away from tax day, how it basically says to our downsized and shrinking middle class here in the United States and the poor and the working poor in this country, surely they're asking, why are we paying taxes when all these rich and powerful people aren't?
Well, exactly. I mean, the kind of people that are using the offshore world are actually the powerful and the rich. And let's make no bones about this. The average person doesn't use an offshore company. The reason they use it is for privacy. They basically don't want anyone to know that they have this money. So it's easy to set up an offshore company in the British Virgin Islands that has a bank account in Switzerland. And if your government goes after you and wonders who owns the money, you just basically you're hiding behind the offshore company. But I'll tell you one interesting thing we found in the documents. We actually found that every time governments or organizations like, say, the OECD or the European Union tried to crack down on this tax avoidance, the offshore world would just move in a different direction and find a way of getting around the legislation. And again, what's significant about this leak is that this information goes right up to the end of 2015. So we're talking the end of December 2015, going back 40 years. So you can almost see, you know, blow by blow, you know, point by point, the offshore world as it evolves. And you see every time someone tries to stop something happening, they find a way around it.
And again, I'm speaking with Gerard Ryle, who's the director of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, headquarters staff in Washington, D.C. He organized the international effort to structure and release the Panama Papers and previously spent 26 years working as a reporter, investigative reporter, and editor in Australia and Ireland. So, again, do you think that there will be Jim Henry's going to be following you on this program, and I've spoken to him before, and he's been hammering away at this for decades. And I did hear, though, today that Senator Carl Levin, he's not in the majority in the Senate, but he's still a powerful voice in the Senate. He's basically saying, well, maybe what we need to do now is go after the ultimate beneficiaries of the offshore world, because after all, there is an onshore world as well of shell companies. The entire state of Delaware is such. So what Levin was saying today in response to the Panama Papers that you helped get to the public, Gerard, is that maybe we should force our big banks here in the United States to question who is behind these shell companies before they take the accounts.
Yeah, well, let me tell you an interesting fact from the papers and the documents we were looking at. There were more than 350 major banks who were actually the clients of Mossack Fonseca. So when we went to Mossack Fonseca and said, here we found an individual who appears on the sanctions list for the U.S., they would turn around and say to us, I'm sorry, that's not our client. And it turned out that as far as they were concerned, it was the bank's client or the accountancy firm client or a law firm's client. They actually didn't even know in some cases who their clients were, who the end customer was, I should say. Basically, the person whose name really appeared or the ultimate beneficial owner of the account. And, I mean, it seems crazy. And again, what these documents show is that the whole system is actually broken. In that they don't know who the clients are, the banks don't tell them who the clients are, the whole system is wrong.
But do you think that the world's elite of business moguls, celebrities and politicians can be shamed in the sense that their global funds are commingled with the scum of the earth, with the Assads, the Gaddafis. And by the way, there's a national security component to that. The North Koreans are using these offshore shell companies and cutouts to get all of the components they need to build nuclear weapons.
Yeah, one of the, my funniest moment when I was doing the research for this was I typed in the word Pyongyang, which is, is the capital of North Korea, and bang, there it was. And there was a company set up with an address there, and then I cross-referenced that with the sanctions list, and there it was. It was actually sanctioned for being the front company for North Korea. Now, how Mossack Fonseca couldn't have known that? I mean, what were they thinking when they accepted these people as a client? It's a beggar's belief. And, and there was another case where Mossack Fonseca only found out that another company was on the sanctions list when their own address, as in Mossack Fonseca's address, was used as the address for the company. And then they came up in a Google search that their address was suddenly on the sanctions list. So it looked like Mossack Fonseca were actually being sanctioned, but in fact, of course, it was one of the companies that they helped set up.
So your organization, Gerard Ryle, the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, and you're with the headquarters there in Washington, D.C., it was founded in 1997, and it's a global network of investigative journalists who collaborate in depth on various investigations. And my understanding is that in this case, the leak of this trove of documentation was first made to the German newspaper Süddeutsche Zeitung, and that was from the database of Mossack Fonseca, which is, I guess, the world's fourth largest offshore law firm situated in Panama. So if this is the tip of the iceberg, then you've got, three other big icebergs as well. Is that the genesis of this story?
Yes, that's how it happened. We'd actually been working with Süddeutsche Zeitung in the past on tax haven stories. And we learned that the German government had actually bought a data set, and it turned out that data set, a very small, very, very, very small subset of what we're looking at eventually, was actually sold to the German government by a whistleblower. And then subsequently that data set was offered to various other governments, including the U.S. government and the IRS and the U.K. government and a few other governments, including Iceland, which turned out to be significant. And then it kind of led from there to once the Süddeutsche Zeitung published a story about the fact that the government had bought this data set and it led to raids on a bank in Germany, they published a story. And from there, they got contacted by an anonymous source that said, you think that's data? Let me show you data.
Wow.
And from there, it kind of went on from there, basically. So we were originally offered a small amount of data, and then the amount of data grew. Obviously, I'm talking about through Süddeutsche Zeitung, who approached us to basically say, hey, look, there are names from all over the world. How about we build a collaboration and we do it together?
Well, there's no question that, that the German tax authorities are pretty tough, aren't they? I mean, I think the IRS would be and is to some extent, but, you know, the Republicans are continually cutting their funds, particularly their enforcement funds. So is this to do with, I mean, do you think this will give the tax authorities around the world a little bit of a impetus, given how brazen it all is?
Well, I can guarantee you that they, that tax authorities around the world have already made millions of dollars from these stories, because people will automatically come forward now and get scared and basically declare what they've been doing. Because if you declare it, you get an amnesty. Whereas if you keep quiet and eventually these documents come into the hands of governments, and remember that we haven't given the documents over to governments and we don't do that, eventually they will get caught. But let me tell you about the difference between the German government and the American government. The German government, they go, they buy these kind of data sets and they pay real money for it. The IRS, it actually enters into a completely different agreement. What happens is it, it goes through a thing called QITAM. So if you were the whistleblower, you'd get a percentage of the final amount that the IRS eventually gets. But the Germans, they just hand the money over straight away and say, yep, we like the data set and we're going to pay you good dollars for it.
And it doesn't matter who the source is.
It doesn't matter who the source
is. Right.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well,
whereas here you've got to prove that you always got to prove that there was wrongdoing and before you even approach the IRS. Mm. Now, having said that, I don't want to criticize IRS because, of course, they're strapped. They don't have the kind of resources. They keep getting stripped of resources. Mm-hmm. But let me tell you, the best way to get people to pay taxes is to scare them with the kind of stories that we've been doing. But believe me, we're not doing it for that reason. We're doing it because we think there's a genuine public interest in this.
Which there clearly is. And I very much thank you, Gerard Ryle, for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Gerard Ryle, who's the director of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists Headquarters Staff in Washington, D.C., who released the international effort to structure, who organized the international effort to structure and release the Panama Papers. Previously spent 26 years working as a reporter, investigative reporter, and editor in Australia and Ireland, including 2 decades at the Sydney Morning Herald and the Age newspaper. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll look further into the Panama Papers. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is James Henry, an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist, and the former chief economist at McKinsey & Company. He is a Global Justice Fellow at Yale University, a senior fellow at Columbia University's Center for Sustainable Investment, and a senior economic advisor to the Tax Justice Network. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Henry.
Good to be with you.
And James, we were speaking just the other day, and we were talking about the Secretary of Treasury's announcement about the success of sanctions and how they've been used and how they could be misused. And in that interview just a few days ago, we talked a little bit about the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists having some information about Putin and how Dmitry Peskov, the Putin spokesperson at the Kremlin, has been fuming about it. Clearly, the Russians knew that something was coming, right? And then on Sunday, this bombshell was dropped by the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, which is now being dubbed the Panama Papers. And we just spoke with the person who oversaw the release of them. So, but this is not the first time, is it, that all this dirt's been dug up?
Oh, no. I mean, this is, unfortunately, I've been at this for, 40 years. And every year, decade after decade, investigators have basically been rediscovering variations on the same basic themes and scandals all over again, many times involving the same basic havens and banks and lawyers, law firms. And so the real mystery here, I mean, this is certainly in terms of the scale of a scandal, this is a big, a big case. It's also impressive because there's so many different countries involved on a global scale. I mean, these were the go-to guys in Panama. If you were a New York bank or a Swiss bank and you really wanted some edgy practice on the part of a law firm, so one theme here is that this, institution in Panama is really part of a global network. I mean, they didn't go out and send bankers to get Putin as a client. You know, they were referred by other enablers around the planet. And so what we see is, in the 1970s, we had the Castle Bank case involving 200 wealthy Americans. We had, General Somoza's private banks. We had the Colombian cartel. In the 1980s, we had the BCCI case and Noriega. 1990s, we had Salinas and many other cases. And recently, we've had all kinds of revelations about more than ever about the global haven industry. And yet, revolution after revelation, for whatever reason, I mean, each time we have journalists getting up on the moral pedestal and they decry these outrages, and then we wait around for something to be done. And it just never is. I think it's relatively simple for the global community to decide once and for all that we're going to clean this stuff up, because it's not only facilitating tax dodging, but it's a host of many other offenses. I mean, financial fraud, like we saw in the 2008 situation, financial crisis, where banks were using special purpose vehicles based in the Cayman Islands because they were underregulated to finance mortgage fraud all over the country. We've seen kleptocrats like Putin making use of offshore havens to conceal wealth. They don't really care about the return on assets from kleptocratic wealth. It's a question of how much they can steal. So, this is really undermining responsible government that's facilitating bribery and corruption, as well as tax dodging. You can imagine a kind of a Star Wars bar scene where there's, the drug dealers and the tax dodgers and the kleptocrats and the financial fraudsters, the banksters sitting around the table all enjoying the same facilities. Ultimately, what's for sale here is financial secrecy and an international haven network that lets this stuff go on endlessly without government regulation.
But is that the reason why it's allowed to go on? Is that there's too many rich and powerful people? I mean, among these 11 million documents that have come out of the so-called Panama Papers, you've got Prime Minister Cameron's father, the Prime Minister of the UK. You've got world leaders in not just Russia, but in Ukraine, in Pakistan, in Iceland, all over the place. So,
this is actually a kind of national security problem. You have the North Koreans using this Panamanian law firm to set up shell companies that allow them to buy illicit supplies for their nuke industry. You had Syria, people on the banned list from Syria doing the same thing. I mean, the list of sort of infractions kind of goes on and on. I think the answer to your question, though, the ultimate question is, given the fact that we have known about this for 50 years, I think this may finally get us to the point where we say, there are all kinds of countries around the planet that are affected by this. There's no evidence that the growth of the haven industry since the 1970s, which has grown at an exponential rate, has helped the world economy. It's just the opposite. And so it's about time to crack down. and to do something about it. It is really, I think, the political clout of the global haven industry. It's populated by some of the world's largest financial institutions, law firms, and accounting firms. In addition to these tiny law firms in Panama, that are keeping this industry growing. There's an awful lot of wealthy people who have a stake in this, and there are politicians, as we've seen in the latest revolutions. You know, the president of Argentina dealing with these people, you know, the president of the Ukraine, Putin. I mean, it's just prime minister of Iceland having an offshore account so he doesn't have to declare his wealth to the public. You know, this is just outrageous. And I think the reason it goes on is partly the influence that the industry has, but we also have the fact that a lot of this money really ultimately is not invested in havens like Panama. It comes back to the first world by way of the conduits, the trusts and shell companies that are set up in the British Virgin Islands or the Cayman Islands or in the 90 other havens around the planet. And then it comes back to first world countries, the first world banks. It's invested in New York and London and Geneva, in the real estate markets there. It's invested basically tax-free by the world's elite. You know, the code word for London is Moscow on the Thames. There's 90,000 Russians who have invested in London property, and it's no accident that property prices for the rich there have soared. The same thing going on right now in Vancouver, where real estate is no longer affordable by ordinary Canadians because of Chinese money flowing out of China. You know, a lot of that is going through the offshore world because, you know, China, for example, or Russia, both of those are cases where there's profound insecurity on the part of the ruling elite about, you know, what's going to happen down the road. Do they have a rule of law? Do they have any protection against arbitrary state action? And so it's kind of not surprising that they would want to have offshore money. But the overall system basically doesn't work because it protects very powerful people, very rich people, and it doesn't contribute to the tax base that the rest of us need in order to pay for education and health and national security. It's basically a zero-sum game between the world's elites that exploit these haven sort of institutions and the financial secrecy they provide, you know, and undermine not only tax laws but also financial regulation and national security as well.
And again, I'm speaking with James Henry. He's an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist, and the former chief economist at McKinsey & Company. He's a global justice fellow at Yale University and a senior fellow at Columbia University Center for Sustainable Investment and a senior economic advisor to the Tax Justice Network. So clearly, this is, as I mentioned, a sort of Robin Hood in reverse situation where you're robbing the third world to reward the first world. And, you know, you've got so many people on this planet that are barely subsisting. And the idea that their wealth is being drained off by their kleptocratic leaders and then ends up making a bunch of people on Wall Street even richer is pretty obscene and pretty hard to swallow.
Well, I was recently in South Africa, for example, and I came across an incredible tax scheme concocted by Morgan Stanley. Morgan Stanley, one of the biggest investment banks in the United States. Well, they were actually selling this very complicated scheme to generate phony tax credits with the help of a Cayman Islands special purpose vehicle, a Delaware company, and 12 other offshore companies, basically depriving the tax authorities in South Africa, who badly need the tax revenue, of several hundred million dollars a year that would have been paid by very wealthy South Africans. This is a scheme that they came up with in the most incredibly sophisticated kind of and financial analytical team. I mean, Harvard MBA is concocting this stuff and basically doing it in a way that is virtually unauditable. In order to track this stuff down, if you didn't have a whistleblower, in the case of the scheme I was looking at, you would never have been able to audit this kind of behavior. Just one example, precise example of the kind of abusive use of these offshore structures by the financial elite. And I think what that suggests is that, you know, we have a tremendous misallocation of resources, all kinds of energy going into concocting financial chicanery and dodging kind of activities that should be channeled elsewhere. So it's not just the lost taxes and the lousy banking. It's also this tremendous waste of human talent on concocting these schemes.
So when Senator Carl Levin says, as he did in response to this these Panama Papers, when asked what should be done, he said one of the first things we could do is get our big banks to reveal who, or at least demand to know who the person is whose account that they're accepting, these shell companies. So could you put the onus back on the big banks?
Well, that would help, but I mean, there's a lot of financial institutions involved in this. It's not just the banks, insurance companies to some extent. If you want to move money to Switzerland, you take out an insurance policy for 5 million euros a year, and then, you know, they park it in Switzerland. And, you know, at the end of the day, you cancel the insurance policy. I mean, there's lots of players in this business, but he's right. If we had a simple step forward, we'd have the major Western governments that are basically supplying the ultimate destinations for all of this funny money. You know, the United States, the UK, Switzerland, you know, Germany, France, these are OECD countries. And also with the help of a few other destination countries, we would have a pretty good quorum for being able to acquire what's called beneficial ownership public registration, which allows you to see, you know, who is the real owner of the trust or the offshore company. And that would be a step forward because, you know, in this case, I mean, thank God for whistleblowers and investigative journalists. It wasn't governments that or law enforcement that came up with this expose, nor have they come up with any of the other exposés over the years. It's basically hardworking journalists and unpaid whistleblowers or, you know, sort of people who are basically doing the right thing here that have come up with these revelations. So if the world community were able to agree on one simple measure, which would be beneficial ownership registration, you know, that would be one step forward. Another would be to have more automatic information exchange among tax authorities. But I think the simple demand for let's know who owns these companies and trusts, you know, that would be a good step forward. I've also proposed what I've called a tax on anonymous wealth, which means that if you have such a vehicle, while we're waiting for all these reforms to get passed, a lot of this money is concentrated in assets under managed, handled by the top 50 international private banks, about $12 trillion, we estimate, of cross-border assets under management by the banks. We could levy a simple 1-2% tax on those assets every year because a lot of that money is just dirty, and we're not going to get we're not going to produce instant reforms on beneficial ownership. Let's at least get some revenue from it that we could apply to climate change relief or to other development costs of the world community. We have, you know, I think this latest revelation may finally get us to the point where we have to take. Or willing to take these kind of actions. But there are powerful opponents to this. You know, this is not just an offshore industry now. It's an onshore industry. If you go to Delaware, there's 950,000 corporations and LLCs registered there. Nobody knows who owns them. There are many trusts there. There's 13 states in the United States that have asset protection trusts that are modeled on the Cook Islands and provide all kinds of protection to extremely wealthy people. You know, there's 49 states that have LLCs for sale, and none of them have beneficial ownership registration. So, you know, this is an institution. This institutional secrecy is something that has a very powerful political constituency. Delaware derives about a third of their state income each year from these corporate registries that they operate. So it's become more of an onshore problem as well as an offshore problem. It's not necessary to go to Panama anymore to hide your money. And so this kind of behavior is beginning to affect tax compliance on the part of the middle classes and the poor, people who, you know, basically are looking at all this chicanery by the elites and saying, why should I pay taxes? What am I, a fool? So that's the real threat here. I think it undermines representative democracy.
Well, James Henry, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Quite welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with James Henry, who's an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist, and the former chief economist at McKinsey & Company. He's a global justice fellow at Yale University, a senior fellow at Columbia University Center for Sustainable Investment, and a senior economic advisor to the Tax Justice Network. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the leverage that Donald Trump has over Fox News. What have we done? How'd we get so far from the sun? Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Gabriel Sherman, who's the National Affairs Editor at New York Magazine and the author of the New York Times bestselling biography of Fox News founder Roger Ailes, The Loudest Voice in the Room, How the Brilliant, Bombastic Roger Ailes Built Fox News and Divided a Country. His latest article at New York Magazine is Operation Trump, Inside the Most Unorthodox Campaign in Political History. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gabriel Sherman.
Thanks for having me.
And in terms of this unorthodox campaign, it's sort of coming to the crunch, is it not, on Tuesday in Wisconsin. I can't believe the extent to which the Republicans are piling on, and I'm also mystified why the Democrats are piling on. If the Republicans are so alarmed that this guy could be their candidate, why are the Democrats helping them trash him?
Well, you know, Wisconsin's going to be a real test of Donald Trump's candidacy. You know, up till this point, he has been able to operate with most bare bones of a staff, has not surrounded himself with a whole coterie of advisors like the other campaigns, and has gotten them this far. But the race is now shifting. We're now moving into a trench warfare style of campaign where it's going to be a battle for every delegate. That is an operation for which Ted Cruz is fully staffed and ready for. Donald Trump is late to that party. And so Wisconsin is going to be, you know, a real test for that, because Cruz and Kasich are likely to walk away with some delegates. And then going into the upcoming primaries, they're going to try to deny Trump the magic 1237 number. So, you know, the other thing I'll point out about Wisconsin is it's really going to be a test of the Stop Trump movement. I mean, Wisconsin is a state governed by Scott Walker. It's the state where Republican Party Chairman Reince Priebus is from. It's also Paul Ryan's home state. So this is a state that has a very well-built and well-oiled machine. It's a machine that is not favorable to Trump, and they are going to turn out their supporters, by all appearances, to vote for Cruz to stop Trump. And so we will see the real depth of this anti-Trump movement in the Republican Party and whether it has the strength to stop him.
So in terms of what you're telling us then, Gabriel Sherman, there are fair means as opposed to foul means by which they may be able to stop him. But could they ever get as many delegates as he will going into this convention?
My latest reading of the math is that it's be very, very difficult for Ted Cruz to get to the 1237 number. Donald Trump still, while it's an uphill and going to be a difficult fight, still has the best pathway to getting to the nomination. But again, as each week goes by, it's becoming more evident that we're likely to see a contested convention in Cleveland. And so that is why you see Donald Trump hiring Paul Manafort, late last month. He is, of course, the legendary Republican strategist who managed Gerald Ford's successful floor fight in 1976 that stopped Ronald Reagan's insurgency. So Trump is readying for a contested convention. There's the question is it too little too late? Because Ted Cruz has been pouring money and resources into this delegate fight for many more weeks, and he's gotten a head start.
Well, it's been reported that in the 2008 campaign, halfway through, Barack Obama realized he was doing incredibly well against Hillary Clinton, who was by far the anointed front runner. And he apparently said, my God, maybe we could win this thing, and suddenly got serious, you know. Is that possible that it happened with Trump, that he wasn't entirely serious going in, and then this extraordinary explosion of support for him has kind of gotten out ahead of him, and now he's sort of catching up and trying to get professional, as you've pointed out?
Oh, yes. So that is a great question. And as I was saying, my piece clearly reports how when Donald Trump launched his campaign, he first started really exploring this seriously in January of 2015. He did not think it was a sure thing, and he hired, you know, a bunch of outsiders and didn't really pour any money into the campaign. And it was only until several weeks into the campaign, when his rallies exploded and the attention and the public interest in his campaign exploded, that he started to think that this thing might have legs. But when he started it, he was really planning to go back to The Apprentice. He was not prepared to stay in this race until the very end, and he was expecting to get into the race and then drop out and go back to reality television. And I think he even surprised himself. I mean, as much as we've all been surprised, I mean, he's the one who has set off the most unlikely dynamics we've seen in Republican politics in probably a generation, or if not more.
And again, I'm speaking with Gabriel Sherman, who's a national affairs editor at New York Magazine and the author of the New York Times bestselling biography of Fox News founder Roger Ailes, The Loudest Voice in the Room, How the Brilliant, Bombastic Roger Ailes Built Fox News and Divided a Country. His latest article at New York Magazine is Operation Trump, Inside the Most Unorthodox Campaign in Political History. So let's talk about your very, very lengthy and thorough article, Gabriel, at New York Magazine. I was struck in that debate where Donald Trump seemed to sort of gratuitously go after Megyn Kelly. I never quite understood why he did it, but he did it, and he got a lot of attention, obviously. And my understanding was that he sort of blackmailed after that Fox News for basically by going to CNBC and CNN and not making himself available. But that's only a tiny bit of the leverage that he had. I didn't realize he had this extraordinary leverage that you've revealed in your article.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that I learned in the course of reporting this piece, and I had a good idea of it before I started, but I came away with a even deeper understanding, is just the way Donald Trump understands power and the way he collects information that he then can use and deploy at the right moment. You know, I report in the piece how when Donald Trump was exploring whether to run for president in 2014 and in 2015, he would take phone calls from Reince Priebus, the Republican Party chairman, and Priebus would think that he was calling Trump to ask for donations to the party. And meanwhile, Trump was vacuuming up information. He was basically interviewing Priebus and asking him about what he saw happening in Republican politics, what was going on in the party. And he was learning this information to his advantage. And yes, as I report in the piece, Donald Trump was brought into a very contentious negotiation that Roger Ailes was having back in 2013 with his longtime PR chief, who was fired over the publication of my book. Roger Ailes, famously paranoid executive, had believed that his PR chief was a chief source of mine. And so he fired him, and the PR chief, Brian Lewis, threatened to go public as a whistleblower because he was in the room for the most scandalous negotiations and conversations that took place in the inner workings of Fox News. And Roger Ailes, not wanting these damaging revelations to go public, called his friend Donald Trump to mediate, because Trump, as it happens, was friends with Brian Lewis's lawyer. And so Donald Trump acted as a private mediator, and these negotiations took place in his office at Trump Tower. And so in the course of these negotiations, you know, of course, he's learning all of the cards that Brian Lewis has to play. And so Donald Trump is sitting on this damaging information that Roger Ailes paid millions of dollars to Brian Lewis to keep out of the public domain. And so now Donald Trump, fast forward 2.5 years, Donald Trump goes to war against Fox News, and he's sitting on this trove of information that Roger Ailes has been trying to keep out of the public. And Ailes knows that, or if he doesn't know that, maybe suspects that Trump knows it. So I think it's just an incredible, vivid example of the way Donald Trump uses power and understands how, through negotiations, he can get information that can pay off many, many months and years down the road.
So is Donald Trump and Roger Ailes kind of, are they meeting their match? Because both of them obviously have huge egos.
Yeah, I published a biography of Roger Ailes. I've covered the media business and politics for the better part of a decade now. I've never seen somebody so effectively go up against Fox News and Roger Ailes the way Donald Trump has. I mean, he is... it's been unprecedented the way in which he has openly stoked and fanned warfare with the network that every Republican was cowed by until Trump. So he really has met his match, and it's been, for me personally, just one of the most fascinating storylines of this presidential election cycle, to see finally somebody on the right start challenging Fox News and not be bullied by them.
But how much do they share in common, this kind of these ego trappings, like Trump's got his plane? My understanding is that he's not the billionaire he says he is, but he has to keep all the trappings going.
Oh, yeah. Stylistically, they're very similar. I mean, they're both blustery, kind of throwback, very old-fashioned kind of executives. They're, you know, unapologetically macho. And, you know, Roger Ailes is obviously, like Donald Trump, somebody who is a master image maker. There's an example I report in my book. I love this old example where Roger Ailes is a young Turk starting out, and he literally walked out of a television interview and said he had a place to be. And he turned to a friend later and said, "Why did you do that?" He said, "Because he wanted to project the image of a busy man." And so, like Donald Trump, Roger Ailes knows how to craft an image of as a real power broker. And so they are. It is like two gladiators getting into the ring and playing at the highest level.
So when Roger Ailes acts, you said he's notoriously paranoid, but he has almost as much Secret Service type protection as the president does. He has big armored limousines and all of this, these trappings. Is this based on real power, or is it what you just told us, the idea that this is just ego boosting gratification?
Yeah, you know, that that's a good question. You know, Roger Ailes likes to tell people that he's been targeted by Al-Qaeda for assassination, and he's always saying that in private that the liberals and left wing are coming after him. I think the honest truth is that a lot of this is invented. I bet you Roger Ailes can walk, you know, through Midtown Manhattan, and chances are most people wouldn't even, you know, pay him much attention. They'd say, "Oh, there's a, you know, an older businessman just walking down the street." You know, I think it's important to point out that Roger Ailes' boss, Rupert Murdoch, a man far richer than he is, that has almost, you know, very scant security detail, and he's just much more of a man who's comfortable out in public. So, yes, I agree. I don't think a lot of Ailes' paranoia about his need for security is not rooted in the actual threat he faces to his safety.
Well, I would say that Rupert Murdoch, arm in arm with Jerry Hall, is an awfully lot more conspicuous in public than this overweight businessman wandering around. If indeed he was prepared to wander around without his security detail, he certainly would go unnoticed, I think.
Yes, and I think, you know, but so going back to, you know, the Trump example, I mean, I think just what this piece shows is it just tried to answer the question of how did this happen, you know. I mean, Donald Trump has been the subject of endless press coverage since he became presidential candidate. But what I tried to do is step back and just put the pieces together and explain in simple terms how this campaign was built and how he's pulled off, no matter what you think of Donald Trump, one of the biggest political upsets of a generation. I mean, even if Donald Trump doesn't go on to win the Republican nomination, the fact that he denied Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio, Scott Walker, and the 15 plus other candidates who are running for president, the nomination is just a remarkable feat. And so I just I think this piece is very helpful to readers who just want to understand, even if you've been following Donald Trump day in and day out, to sort of step back and understand how this really unprecedented political story has come to be.
And indeed, he's denied the people that would be probably the most formidable against Hillary Clinton, even though they didn't do that well. But he certainly...
Yeah, you know, one of the things that I really got a kick out of is when I was touring his campaign headquarters in Trump Tower in Manhattan, on the wall is a handmade poster that's titled A Wall of Shame. And it's kind of really unflattering photographs of all of the other Republican candidates that have dropped out of the race so far. And you just... You know, obviously we all know this, but you just look at it on the wall and it's like a whole lineup of mugshots. And it's pretty impressive that Trump was able, you know, Bobby Jindal, Scott Walker. I mean, these governors who have really, you know, a lot of respect and bona fides in the conservative movement. Jeb Bush, who's the heir to, you know, one of the greatest American political dynasties of all time. Marco Rubio, who was, you know, like the Barack Obama of the Republican Party, the fresh face who was going to carry it into the future. I mean, you just go down the list, and it's they were all destined to be formidable candidates. You know, pundits, I'm also just struck that pundits have been remarking all throughout this campaign cycle that this was the deepest Republican field in memory, and they were all stopped by Donald Trump, you know, save Ted Cruz and John Kasich so far. So I just think that is, whatever happens from here on out in the race, still just a remarkable story that I was, you know, just real honored to be able to cover.
So do you think, though, that since he's playing catch-up and getting a professional staff, and he's been winging it pretty much from the beginning, and that he's as surprised by the enormous support that he's got as everybody else is it too late? I mean, there's an interesting article in Monday's New York Times about Bernie Sanders, how he sort of figured out, perhaps too late, how to win when he didn't get off a quick start because he didn't get the right staffing together. Now you're saying that Trump's starting to get the right staffing together, but is he too late, do you think?
You know, that is a good question. I think, I mean, the only definitive way to answer that is just to see what happens. I mean, I'm loath to predict the future in a race where in a year when nothing has happened as it seemed. But I will say this. I remember going back to last summer, I wrote a long piece, a piece for New York Magazine long ago about how Trump was building, just getting his campaign going. And I remember reporting that piece, and everyone was telling me even back then in August of 2015 how it was too late, and Trump wasn't spending money on ads, and Trump won't spend money on this. And everyone was predicting that as soon as, you know, Labor Day happened and the quote, serious season started and everyone paid attention after the summer circus, that Trump was doomed to fail. And that didn't happen. So as much as I think there are serious question marks about Trump's ability to peel off these delegates and to keep the delegates loyal to him after a first or second ballot, I do think he's defied expectations. And every time people said he wasn't doing what was expected to be done, it didn't cost him. So I think people should just kind of consider both when if they're kind of trying to speculate what may or may not happen. I think anyone who just says, oh, Donald Trump is not playing by the rules and that's game over for him, has just been proved wrong time and time again.
Well, just in closing then, Gabriel Sherman, I've been for some time looking into Paul Ryan running and being sort of playing it coy like he did with the speakership, which he eventually took. Now, of course, Politico's reporting that senior Republicans are telling Ryan that he's going to have to run. So would Donald Trump's threat then, if he keeps saying, if I'm not treated well, I'll go third party. Is it too late for him? And does he have the money and resources?
That's a great question. You know, that's an area where, in terms of timing, yes, I actually do think it's too late for that. The filing deadlines to get on ballots in Texas and North Carolina are basically passed, and he's rapidly approaching filing deadlines for a host of other states. And, you know, by July, when the convention happens, if they do draft Ryan on a second or third ballot, and Trump, he really will have nowhere to walk away. I mean, he could maybe get on the ballot in a handful of states and be a spoiler, but there would be zero chance to become president as a third party. The only way, my understanding of the electoral math is that he could spoil and maybe deny Ryan some electoral college votes in a handful of states, but there would be no way Trump could get to a number that would make him president. So, you know, is he going to want to send millions of dollars to basically launch a suicide mission against Ryan? I just doubt that. So I think you got to take that with a grain of salt. That's a lot of bluster. I don't see any scenario by which Trump goes third party.
But what leverage will he have at the convention?
He will have his, you know, he will basically have, well, on the first ballot and the second ballot, and every state's different, he will have the delegates that are pledged to vote for him. And then barring that, the leverage he has, the ultimate leverage, is his megaphone. And he's been deploying that, you know, from the start of his campaign. And Trump is out there and he's told me that he has millions and millions of supporters. And they will be outraged if he is denied the nomination in some backroom smoky backroom deal. And so Paul Ryan really going to have his presidential ambitions marred by Donald Trump spending the months after the Cleveland convention railing against Paul Ryan, railing against the Republican Party, and leading kind of a populist revolt to spoil and you know, either telling his supporters not to vote for Ryan, or even some kind of bizarre revenge mission where he would tell them to vote for Hillary Clinton. I mean, I think all bets would be off if he's denied the nomination in some sort of chicanery in the electoral backroom. So I think Ryan, that's the leverage he has, is that Trump will lead this movement against the party, and that the calculus that the party is making is they will, you know, certainly lose the election if Trump leads a grassroots revolt against the party in November, because they need the white working class base, the Reagan Democrat base, is kind of the bedrock of the Republican coalition. And if Trump leads them away from the Republican Party, there's not really a plausible way by which they can, you know, beat Hillary Clinton. I think that's the calculus. That's the conversation that you're hearing in Republican circles at this point.
Right. And I certainly don't see a Paul Ryan with Donald Trump as his vice president.
So. No, I think that's one certainty we can say will not happen.
Well, Gabriel, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Gabriel Sherman, who's a national affairs editor at the New York Magazine and the author of the New York Times bestselling biography of Fox News founder Roger Ailes, The Loudest Voice in the Room, How the Brilliant, Bombastic Roger Ailes Built Fox News and Divided a Country. His latest article at New York Magazine is Operation Trump, Inside the Most Unorthodox Campaign in Political History. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The headline written down in a minute.